This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Well, we're the Wild West, and what a wild week of news, y'all. Today on CityCast Las Vegas, I'm here with contributor Andrew Corrali and, drumroll if you got it, our brand new co-host, Sarah Lohman. We're going to be talking about how Vegas is avoiding the largest hospitality strike in history, how downtown Las Vegas bounced back after the pandemic, and may have done it in the way that's the best in the country. And we'll wrap up today with some fun Q&A with Sarah Lohman. It's Friday, November 10th. I'm David Figler, and here's what Las Vegas is talking about. Andrew Corrali, welcome to CityCast Las Vegas.
Hey, good morning, David. Great to be here.
And Sarah Lohman, welcome to your first official podcast here as our co-host.
Thank you, David. I got myself a new job. It's this job, being a co-host. I'm absolutely pumped. You know I love Las Vegas.
I do. And you've been such a great guest on CityCast in the past, and I'm looking forward to our future together as co-hosts.
Yeah, I was super lucky that I was a contributor before because I realized that I really loved the CityCast team. So I applied, and a million interviews later, here I am. I'm sorry to anyone I beat out for this job. We can still be friends, I promise. I'm super nice.
We're all friends.
Thunderdome complete.
Well, and now here we are in the Friday News Roundup. So let's get to it, man. Andrew Corrali, the strike is averted. Culinary has a contract. What's going on?
Yeah, very exciting. So this week, the Culinary had a couple of announcements. It announced Wednesday that it had reached a tentative labor deal with Caesars Entertainment. And then on Thursday morning, announced that they reached a tentative deal with MGM International. So this is kind of exciting because it heads off the ugly but possibly exciting prospect of a strike that was originally scheduled for today. So this strike would have been of historic proportions. You're going to be hearing that word a lot. Historic. Because it would have, also just taken place a week before the high-profile F1 race and, would have, by all accounts, thrown a big, fat monkey wrench into the racing festivities. So, the deal is, people are very excited about it. Ted Papageorge, the Secretary Treasurer of the Culinary, says this is a historic deal, covers, all these MGM and Caesars properties. It's for 5 years, covers, I think, almost like 20,000 employees. So, no strike for us.
Yeah. And I should note that we're recording this on Thursday when properties have yet to sign off. But I think that it's pretty much inevitable. The big ones have already done it. Wynn will, in all likelihood, follow suit.
Yes. We are in a fact fluid environment.
Exactly. But both, the union and the companies, like you said, Andrew, are calling this deal historic. Certainly is some of the biggest pay increases that we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. A lot of other concessions, too. Does our union success here, you think, bode well for other unions across the country? Or is this a very special case?
No, I mean, I think that we're seeing unions as a huge movement across the country. It's really exciting to see unions like back and perhaps better than ever. I mean, of course, we saw the writers' strike. I want to say that the actors' strike has come to a conclusion.
Yep, that ended. That ended 2 days ago.
Yeah. So I saw on Instagram, I have a friend that was posting from the picket lines every day, and he posted from home the other night. So I was like, wait, is there a deal? I come from a museum background too, and so I'm seeing more and more museums also unionize as well. So there is a movement back to, let's make sure we have a decent standard of living here. So, I can't say, but my hope is that this is just one event in a major sea change for our country.
I mean, Andrew, what do you think? Did the casinos ever even stand a chance?
Oh, I thought that this, the momentum behind the culinary, I think Sarah points to this, you know, this kind of like, sort of momentous narrative. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for labor right now. And when people do these Gallup polls and they ask for their support for organized labor, it's polling really high. So I feel like that the culinary had, you know, the sort of the strong hand all along. But I hate to be the cloud that rains on the parade on Sarah's first day, but I think it's important to look at the big picture as well. And this sounds like a great deal for the culinary. Secretary Treasurer Ted Papageorge, straight shooter. So when he says historic, I'm like, okay, that sounds good.
I mean, I believe on historic. I don't know that any union official in that posture is always straightforward or transparent. But I'm going to let you finish, Andrew Crawley.
Fair enough. I mean, I've known him personally over the years in covering labor, and that's been my impression as a journalist, that he's been, you know, straightforward, honest, and earnest. So I guess whenever he throws around the word historic, it carries a bit more weight. And so these tiered pay increases sound good. The protections against being replaced by robots, I think that's very prescient, because that's going to be, you know, a big conversation that all of society is going to be having. The daily room cleanings, reinstating that, I think it's just good marketing and good common sense.
But people have missed it.
Yeah. But I think the big picture to me suggests that the culinary in some ways is kind of a shining exception to the broader narrative of what's happening with labor. And I did a little research, and only 6% of, you know, folks in the private workforce are part of an actual labor union, as opposed to like 35% back in the day in the 50s. And so, you know, since then, you know, due to, you know, federal regulations, the rise of the gig economy, manufacturing going overseas, Ronald Reagan, you know, the power of labor has, you know, been diminishing, you know, year over year. So I think in some ways it's a hopeful exception to the dominant current of what's going on with organized labor. So it gives me, you know, provisional tentative hope.
Yeah. And, you know, just people have been referring to Vegas as a union city, you know, as I'm sort of evangelizing my relatively new, I moved here about 2 years ago. And as I talk to my friends across the country, and, you know, people think of Vegas as the strip, which, you know, has so much to do with this. But now their second thought is, yeah, and it's a really good union city. So I think that this has also brought like a lot of, you know, maybe we will be sort of a leader in terms of encouraging other people to unionize and strike. And the momentum on this has been amazing.
You know, it is funny, though, like, the perception of Las Vegas as a union town, and certainly culinary union, so powerful, so strong, so important in our community. But we're also a right-to-work state, and there are, you know, a lot of really hostile to worker environs throughout the state. So it is a really interesting dichotomy. I want to get back to the actual threat of the strike, though. I mean, I've been called out by some of my friends who are in the culinary for, you know, pointing out the theatrics of a lot of what had occurred. And, you know, I think it, objectively, one can say that culinary employed several tactics in the lead up to these discussions. The pretend arrest, and I'm never going to let go of that. The making and the, you know, the actual constructing of strike signs and all that. I mean, are these legitimate tactics that the culinary has to use, or is it become distraction?
I think that's a really interesting question. And on the socials, there's a bit of cynicism about the theater component of, you know, showing this seriousness of intent to strike. And I guess I don't see it. I'm a bit less cynical about it. And I think in the age of, you know, social media and, you know, virality, I think that the theater is a valuable and legitimate tactic. And it shows, you know, again, the seriousness of their intent. And I almost feel like we're in an age where, you know, acting and theater, you know, is kind of reality in this sense. So I don't necessarily have a problem with it.
Yeah, I think it's just getting the word out, right? You know, they did an amazing job of making people aware of what was happening.
Right.
I mean, also because, like, the consequences were so high, too. And I kind of honestly admire them for that, the way that they've timed this, you know, right before a major event. I think they did. I've seen worse.
there's no doubt that the consequence to the city that's about to embark upon these very high-profile strip city events was there, but there was no stakes at all. And I think it's just literally an affront to people who actually protest for something that they believe in and do it at risk of being mistreated, maybe even physically, by the police and arrested, which happens on the Las Vegas Strip for people who have positions that the police don't agree with, such as that we need police reforms. And that just happened two summers ago. You know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who didn't expect to be arrested were in fact arrested, some taken to jail, some which had their entire lives disrupted, mothers, grandmothers, young people. I mean, the police were not kind to them.
That's not the strikers or the protesters' fault, right? Like,
no, but when they come out and compare themselves to the great civil disobedience leaders and the people like Martin Luther King that actually came out in a culinary press release saying that this arrest was akin to that. Look, the carceral system is broken. You call up the police, which, by the way, are also union members here, the PPA, and say, okay, we're going to arrange ahead of time for 50 people to be arrested. And then, but they're just going to be taken away for the, yes.
Oh, it was definitely scripted. Yeah.
And then we're just going to take them away for the cameras. And then we're going to unrelease them and give them citations, which I almost assure you will be dismissed by the prosecutor's office. There is nothing at stake there other than a theatrical thing using, I would say, abusing the police system and letting them off the hook, like making the police, in a way, part of the good guys on this. When people actually come out and put something on the line to protest, the police are not always the good guys.
No.
And so to me, that was crossing a line for me.
I totally get your perspective on this, obviously coming from a law background, your lawyer, David, right now. Did the means justify the end? You know, I'm not sure. I think that I am willing to subtract the individual choices here that were maybe not as wise for, you know, the incredible life benefits this is going to have for such a large percent of the population here in Las Vegas. But I think your points are valid.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome, David.
You are validated.
Yeah, you know, sometimes...
There actually is a whole parallel history of scripted symbolic protests. Mm. And it actually takes me back in mind to the long history of protests at the Nevada test site. And those were definitely done in, you know, almost a scripted fashion in which people would, you know, cross the line and be arrested. It was expected. And I remember thinking when I would see this, wow, this almost sounds like it was sort of organized.
Very different than collaborating and negotiating with the police to make sure everything goes right. Yes, sometimes people go out knowing they're going to be arrested. That is very different from what we saw and very different from what Culinary presented what they were doing. And I just feel like I get it. You got to pull out all the stops to get to where you are to assert your power position. But that's a sandbox that they really shouldn't be playing around in because the stakes there are far more significant than how it was presented. That's all.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
All right, let's move on to issue two, near and dear to my heart as a downtowner. There was something that came out recently that suggests that downtown Las Vegas bounced back from the pandemic better than anyone. Did we, Sarah? What was the newest on that?
Yeah, so I got to say there's a lot of ins and outs and what have yous and some contradictions with this article. So the article that we looked at is from the Las Vegas Review-Journal. And I just want to say that it unfortunately didn't link to the study this is based on because it was based off a live talk. But a woman named Karen Chappell, who's an urban studies researcher at the University of Toronto, she looked at the resiliencies of downtowns, I assume both in the United States and in Canada. And she used mobile phone location data. So a little bit like how Google determines where there's a traffic jam, still a little creepy, You know, robot overlords are watching. But so she was able to basically track our movements to figure out, you know, which downtowns of various sized cities have come back. And Las Vegas's downtown has recovered post-pandemic to 103% of its pre-pandemic mobile phone activity. So basically,
pandemic.
Yeah, we're back
and
better
three.
Than ever.
Yeah.
So here is their theories on why, that we're back and like better than ever, that we've seen actually growth in our downtown post-pandemic. And it's basically because Las Vegas does not have a traditional downtown. Most city, mid-size and big city downtowns are office spaces, right? They're traditionally places that people have commuted to go to work. And in my experience, have been like ghost towns after 5 p.m., right? But our downtown, while it does have some of our government buildings and things like that, we're not a like office building city, right? So much of our labor is within entertainment. So much of our downtown is about, we were talking about some of the performance venues down there and bars and restaurants. You know, it's a totally different downtown than most cities. So they also attribute, because it's not just us, it's some other Southwestern cities as well, that we have like better weather, which of course has made the pandemic easier on us all, you know, all told, because we had more accessible outdoor space too, where people felt safer. And so I think that the abundance of outdoor spaces in our downtown also has something to do with it too. So that is that's the gist.
Andrew, do these stats that seem to have been presented at this conference, do they line up with your experience of our downtown?
Yeah, that's interesting, because it kind of basically says, because we don't have that sort of, you know, level of professional class that, you know, that is working from home, that we, our particular downtown didn't suffer. So yeah, it is kind of a, you know, an interesting sort of backhanded compliment to our, you know, unique downtown.
Yeah, I should point out that that's the deal, that like now that we've switched to working from home, like other downtowns, you know, don't have people returning to work the same way that ours did. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess what I got out of this study is it maybe suggested to me, and we could talk about this, is like, what ingredient does that suggest that, you know, our downtown should have to, you know, continue its, you know, its vibrancy and success? And it seems to say to me that, you know, maybe downtown should have things that are, you know, destination worthy for going there in itself, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, a downtown where, you know, that has things to do because you happen to be there, more like conveniences, you know. So I thought that was interesting. And for me, I mean, downtown needs housing, you know, housing.
Yes.
You need people circulating in there and, you know, creating that, you know, that substrate of effervescent, you know, human energy that, you know, makes cool downtowns.
Yeah, not just housing, but affordable housing is one of the things that they pointed to say, like, this is what's going to continue this area to thrive. But honestly, the more I thought about this article, the more confused I was, because if we're talking about a downtown that's more akin to other areas, maybe that's actually the Strip, not what we call downtown. You know what I mean? It's strange to sort of compare that area to like the financial district in New York. I worked in New York for 2 weeks back in October, and, you know, I lived there for a long time, too. And so I'm guessing, like, the downtown of New York is, like, the financial district, so the same vibes. People go there during the day. They go home at night. And actually, I went down there recently to hit up a bar and a restaurant, which is also kind of unusual. And there were actually people out on the streets and, like, going out to bars and restaurants. And the big shift since I left in 2018 is that they built more housing in the financial district. So it used to be this neighborhood you would never consider living in because it didn't really have resources for someone actually who wanted to set up house in the neighborhood. But it seems to be becoming more of like a Gen Z area because there is the newer housing there, and then they begin to add other services. So that's the other thing that this article points out. If we want our downtown to continue to thrive, affordable housing, walkability, which is something else I love.
Amen.
And then we have to talk about resources like grocery stores. And I think I would like to add too, that, you know, those three things are also gentrifying, and we have to think about, especially with that area, how to gentrify for all, which is possible, how to make sure we serve the residents who are already there while drawing in new people to continue to build up on that neighborhood.
To me, I appreciate the cell phone data, but we've always been sort of a mixed use, if you will, when it comes to locals and tourists in this area. And really, none of us could ever truly agree on what are the boundaries of downtown. What does downtown mean?
Your downtown is like suburbia. Like, it's totally different than like downtown Fremont Street.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I mean, I consider myself to be a downtown person, and, you know, it's purely residential. And there are those office buildings, and there are those courthouses, and there is a mass exodus from the downtown area for all those office workers every day at 5 o'clock. The courthouse empties, the law offices empty, the other office buildings. Some people do linger because there are so many food and beverage offerings. We also have a downtown unlike any other downtown I've ever seen, that I counted them yesterday, that there are 16 coffee shops.
Wow.
In basically a 2 mile radius of each other. I mean, that's a weird kind of quirk of Las Vegas.
We have good coffee here. It's true.
I don't hate it.
Yeah, hella coffee.
But like, you know, I would say too that like that is kind of what I mean by like gentrification for all. Like everybody loves a good cup of coffee. So I also want to see those coffee shops, you know, offer like a $2 cup, right? So that everyone in the neighborhood could access it. Like I don't want spaces to be exclusive.
Well, now the new Winnie and Ethel's has 25 cent coffee a cup. So it's happening.
Amazing.
Yeah.
This is what I like to hear. This is what I love to hear. Yeah, coming from Cleveland, too, which is where I grew up, and our downtown really was a ghost town after 5 p.m., the biggest shift that happened down there is when they put a grocery store in. They took, honestly, an abandoned bank from Cleveland's heyday, and they put inside the most gorgeous grocery store I've ever seen, and that was a huge game changer. So as long as people know they have access to services, and we are a driving city, but still, isn't it like nice to be able to walk to a grocery store, too?
Oh, sure. Look, I appreciate downtown Las Vegas being lauded for its recovery. I think that there are a lot of factors that weren't considered by the study. And I think that a lot of the suggestions from the study were a little wonky, too. Like, oh, you need more big sporting events like the Super Bowl and the Oakland A's coming with the stadium. It's like, oh, come on.
That was ironic because I know we're not excited about the A's.
Yeah, I mean, I God bless a researcher from Canada, probably really knows her stuff, but is her stuff really that instructive to us? I mean, they were talking about walkability. There are some pockets of walkability downtown, but walk down one of those sidewalks with all the fencing and the poles in the middle of the street. It's not really accessible to people with challenges or disabilities.
Yeah, or not yet.
Even the parents with strollers. I mean, the traffic situation is really bad with the speeds and the width of the streets. I could go on and on and on. I mean, look. Downtown Las Vegas may be resilient because it has a very unique set of offerings to both locals and tourists, but by the same token, it is not utopia. Never has been. Is hard-pressed to be, but it's also very hot right now, and I just hope that that momentum creates thoughtful new growth and not just growth for the sake of growth.
And I would love to see more building on those empty lots downtown than I would further and further out into the desert and into Red Rock, for God's sakes.
Well, and that was one of the points that that Dave Swallow from the RTC says, like, you know, we'd love to focus more on walkability and transit and stuff, but the city keeps building out and out and out, and we have to serve places that we don't normally go.
I mean, maybe I'm just a city girl, but I would much rather like live downtown and have this walkable accessibility to not just resources, but community rather than, you know, be sort of in my own house on the edge of town. Sorry, people who live on their own houses on the edge of town. But that's just my preference. And so I would like to see maybe housing available for both.
Yeah. Well, anytime you want to come downtown, downtowners Andrew Corrali and David Figler would love to show you all the fun stuff.
I mean, that sounds like a party. I'm absolutely in.
All the cool things.
Let's get to our final topic, and this is the one I've been looking forward to.
Oh my gosh.
We're going to call this Get to Know Her. Get to know Sarah Lohman, our new co-host.
I called it Sarah Lohman Blitz Question Attack.
So, I'm like a little nervous. Woo!
It's like, I don't want to call it speed dating, maybe speed hosting.
Speed dating your future host, your current future host. Okay.
All right. So, Sarah, let's do your villain origin story, or is it your hero origin story? Tell us about your move to Vegas. What brought you here?
Yeah. Yeah. So I already name dropped all the places that I lived in. I was in New York for 13 years. I'm from Northeast Ohio. 2018, I moved to Cleveland, which is also where I went to school. Luckily, was there during the pandemic. I say that because my parents are also there. And literally, I have a best friend, shout out to Kim Miller, who was born and raised here. Whenever I would visit her, I would get to see the real Las Vegas, like all of the different things that makes this place so cool. And honestly, a little after the pandemic, her brother got a new job and sent me a text message and was like, I travel a lot. I really need someone to take care of my cats. Do you want to move to Las Vegas?
Oh, the cats. They'll suck you in every time.
So it's basically a permanent cat sitting deal long term.
Yeah. I mean, I moved out and now I'm in my
it's
old
your residency.
Place in... Yeah. So I did a residency for 2 years. So I moved in August of 2021. And now I'm actually in my own place in Townsite Henderson. I'm a real Henderson nerd. I love this neighborhood.
I love that. Townsite Henderson. Because you're old school Henderson.
Damn, she claimed OG right from the start.
Yeah.
She's like not far from Water Street. I love that.
No. Walkable to Water Street, which is exactly what I love. Like, to me, it has it all. Like, I have a walkable neighborhood, but it's also really easy for me to get out into nature and also really easy for me to, like, go downtown and enjoy all the offerings there.
All right. Hey, Sarah, let's just get to this. And let's just do this popcorn style. Andrew, you and I will go back and forth and pepper her with questions. But rapid fire. No explanations, no disclaimers.
Oh,
just what comes to mind. You ready, Sarah?
Oh, free association. Okay, let's go.
All right. What is your favorite pizza in town?
Evil pie.
If you were in control of the sphere for one day, what would you display on it?
Boobies.
Boobies.
Maybe a uniboob, since it's one sphere.
Yeah, exactly. Just one. Just the good one.
Yeah, just one. Yeah. I just like round things work better on it. So that's the first thing that came to mind.
Okay. Which notable Las Vegan would you be most okay getting stuck in an elevator with?
Whiskey Pete. I hear he was very handsome.
Okay. First of all, Whiskey Pete, I'm not going to call him a Las Vegan.
Rapid
so
fire.
I want you to reset. No, reset. Whiskey Pete's a prim guy. Come on.
Is he a mascot?
All right. Move on. Go, Andrew. Whiskey Pete.
Main Street or Water Street?
Water Street, baby.
Oh, boy. April or October?
April.
Oh.
Mojave Max or Chance the Gila Monster?
Oh, you're really tearing my heart in twain here.
It's that reptile conundrum. Reptile's choice. Sophie's reptile
Max,
choice.
The Gila Monster. Tortoises. I'm sorry. They're just so stupid.
Go, Knights, go! Go, Knights, go!
But Gila Monsters are really adorable. And if you make them really mad, they'll try to poison you.
And Chance is the most adorable of them all. Although my entry to that is Finn the Bat Dog. Okay, Sarah, where are you most likely to be on a Saturday night?
Oh, this is a great question. Probably trying out like a cocktail bar.
Nice. What is your Vegas life hack?
Ooh, that's a good last one.
Okay. Just get out of the city, you know? We forget, but it's like so close. Living in Henderson, at my first place here, I could literally walk out into the desert. And sometimes you just need that reset. Walk out into the desert. Bring water.
Ain't that the truth? Sometimes the best way to love Las Vegas is get the F out of Las Vegas for a little bit.
Great answers.
Mm-hmm. All right. I said that was the last one, but I got one more that's maybe a little closer to home. And you've got like almost 400 to choose from here, Sarah. So here comes the question. What has been so far your favorite CityCast Las Vegas episode?
Oh, my God.
And I'm going to disqualify the ones that you were on.
Shoot, I was going to say buffets.
Yeah.
I do really love that episode.
No, that was a great episode, but come on, bring it.
Okay. I have one and then a close second. I really love the quizzes that you did with Vogue about like Las Vegas history, both because I'm a history nerd and because I'm very competitive. So I hope that...
Oh, the Corey Levitan ones. Yeah, those are totally fun.
Those are really fun. And so I hope I get to waste you in a trivia contest at some point. And then my second fave is the recent one you did about the road trip up to Tonopah, because I just decided to do that this past weekend with my friend and experience some weird Nevada.
The practical applications of CityCast Las Vegas episodes. Yeah. Awesome.
I took your advice. I made a map and then I went and did it.
And I'm imagining if people follow you on social media, they could probably see some pictures from that trip.
They absolutely can. I just posted them. I just went this past weekend.
You have a really fun handle on Instagram. Why don't you shout that one out?
My handle is @4poundsflower. It's all spelled out, 4poundsflower. That's where you can find me, as well, of course, as on the CityCast LV Instagram, too.
Quick lineage. What is the handle in reference to?
So in my other life, when I'm not your favorite host on CityCast, I am a food historian and I blogged for many, many years. That's how I got my career started. And I love alliteration. And I was just looking through, I have a huge collection of historic cookbooks, and I found a recipe for wedding cake from the 1830s. And that's how the recipe starts, 4 pounds flour. And my reaction was really like, that's a shitload of cake.
That sounds like a lot of flour. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just thought it was really funny. And that sort of like became my tag for all my food history work.
I love it. And I love the work that you do with food history.
Thanks, David.
You have books out. People should check that out as well.
What a specific anecdote.
Yeah, right? It's so amazing. Yeah. Anyway, but the books are great.
David, you're being so nice. You're making me feel bad for being a little mean to you this episode.
That's all right. I could take it. Right. Look, John Ralston shit on me a couple days ago, so I could take what Sarah Lohman's got. Hey, Sarah Lohman, welcome to CityCast Las Vegas as the co-host. And Andrew Crawley, always a favorite contributor. Thanks for being back here for the Friday News Roundup.
Aww.
Thank you.
For sure.
And that is all for today here on CityCast Las Vegas. Our executive producer is Sonia Cho Swanson. Our producer is Layla Muhammad. Our newsletter editor is Scott Dickensheets. And your hosts are Sarah Lohman and me, David Figler. Music is by OG Moose, Epidemic Sound, and All the Kimonos. We record this show on the traditional homelands of the Nuuvi, the Southern Paiute people. And also this week, special thanks to A.K. Al Mumin and Lizzie Goldsmith. If you enjoyed the show, go tell a friend, rate the show, leave us a review, and subscribe to our morning newsletter. We'll be back Monday morning with more news from around the city. Till then, stay lucky.
I was just thinking that I would like never want a robot blackjack dealer because I think it takes away, or like any kind of card dealer, it takes away from like what is appealing about that interaction, right?
Right,
so I would want that.
Right, definitely.
I got an old piece that I love bringing back to have like a Westworld Yul Brynner blackjack dealer who's just malfunctioning, just draw,
his face just
draw,
falls off.
draw, and then he shoots you. So yeah, I could see that. I don't know.